Good evening. Just a short time ago, Ukraine's President Zelensky spoke out about Russia's increasing efforts to occupy territory in the east of Ukraine and the Russian way of war.
Forever, the Russian army will be written in history as the most barbaric and inhumane army in the world. The targeted killing of civilians and destruction of residential buildings with all kinds of weapons, including those that are forbidden by international conventions. This is just a trademark of the Russian army, and this will truly mark the Russian Federation as the source of evil.
Well, for its part, Russia today said the war in Ukraine has entered a new phase, only they still continue to refuse to use that word, calling it a war. Quoting the Russian foreign minister, another stage of this operation is beginning, and I'm sure this will be a very important moment of this entire special operation, end quote. Well, it certainly is an important moment. He's not wrong about that, but it's important to understand the reality of this moment. These moments were captured in Ukraine's second largest city, Kharkiv, in a residential neighborhood. People dead after Russian bombardments. A military official there says the shelling has intensified in at least four districts in the city. Those images from the Associated Press. These moments come to us from Reuters. Again, another residential neighborhood in Kharkiv. And again, human beings, neighbors, friends, mothers and fathers dead lying in the street from Russian bombardments. It's another example of why one aide to Ukraine's President Zelensky told CNN there is not a single place safe in Ukraine. And we should point out that while Russia and Ukraine agree that the war has entered a new phase, a U.S. Defense Department official today says that the battles we're seeing in the east, quote, are preludes to larger offensive operations. In other words, the violence is about to get worse, and this is just a run-up to it. Already, the town of Kremina has fallen. That's in the eastern Luhansk region. A Ukrainian military official says the civilians are trying to evacuate even as shelling occurs, quote, from all directions. In the bombed-out city of Mariupol, a Ukrainian commander who says he and other soldiers and civilians are holed up in a steel factory surrounded by Russian forces spoke with CNN today, calling the situation critical. We have only a few days or even hours left, he said. He asked for a third country to be allowed to extract civilians and military who are in that factory with dwindling supplies and desperate medical needs. Ukrainian officials said today that Russian forces had begun bombing and shelling the factory. Also, Ukrainians released a tape captured by their security services. It's something CNN, of course, has not been able to verify independently. It appears to show, or you'll hear, a Russian soldier speaking with a woman about the horrors yet to come from Mariupol.
We are expecting surprises from Russia here.
What kind of surprises?
3-ton ones from the sky, said to level everything to the ground.
Will there be some kind of explosion?
They said to level everything to the ground.
Oh.
They are being bombed and bombed. They are knocking them out.
Well, they said to level everything to the ground. That is what the man said in that tape. And that's why Ukrainians believe that what happens in the east and in the south may determine the future of the country. The White House says that President Biden and world leaders spoke about the situation on a secure video call today, reiterating their commitment to aid Ukraine. And there's late word tonight that the administration is preparing another $800 million weapons package. We have live reports in the central and eastern parts of the country tonight. Ed Lavandera is in Kyiv, the capital. Clarissa Ward in the Donbass region in the east. We start with Ed Lavandera and the story of one son's desperation.
Oleksiy Karuk is searching for answers in a place where answers were buried or bombed. But Oleksiy must find his father. Igor Karuk disappeared while helping a friend escape the war zone west of Kyiv.
He talked about it so lightheartedly that I felt like everything would be all right. We didn't have information that civilians were being shot, so I wasn't worried.
On March 8th at 8 o'clock in the morning, you got seven different texts from your dad. What do they say?
He said that he is going to drive here near Bordanka, yes, to take his friend and to bring him to Kyiv.
What did you write back to him?
I asked him to be careful, to care for himself, and that's all.
Those were the last words father and son exchanged. Oleksiy is joined by his father's friend, Andriy Filin. They're looking for Igor's car, hunting for clues in the neighborhoods ravaged by Russian forces. putting up pictures of the 48-year-old father of two boys, hoping someone has answers. Unraveling the mysteries of what happened to countless missing people is another horrific chapter in this war. In the aftermath of Russia's siege around Kyiv, Oleksiy and Andriy are on their own to find Igor. How difficult is it to do this? So many days searching and searching and no answers.
I don't know words because we don't know where he may be.
This map shows the ground they've covered looking for Igor, but so far every question leads to another dead end.
До речі, да, нам сказали, що можна на штрафплощадках ще подивитись, пошукати.
Брусилів райвідділ, там є штрафплощадка.
Брусилів, да?
Да.
That lead didn't help. Then the men discovered four civilian cars scorched on a quiet road. Inside one of the cars, human bones were visible. Andriy thought one of the cars might be Igor's.
When you arrived here and you saw this, what did you feel?
I just cry. I don't see anything because I have cried.
It wasn't Igor Karuk's car.
It's not his car.
Do you still think you can find him alive?
Hope dies the last.
Hope dies last?
Yes. Yeah.
The search continues for this father who vanished in the war.
Hope dies last. Ed Levender joins us now from Kyiv. Clarissa Ward is in the Donbass region in the east. Clarissa, before Ed's piece, we played a clip of what's purported to be a Russian soldier talking about how he received orders to level everything to the ground at the steel factory in Mariupol that's said to be housing civilians as well as soldiers, many of whom are in desperate need of medical attention. I just want to play this recording again. Again, this is was released by Ukrainian security services.
We are expecting surprises from Russia here.
What kind of surprises?
3-ton ones from the sky, said to level everything to the ground.
Will there be some kind of explosion?
They said to level everything to the ground.
Oh.
They are being bombed and bombed. They are knocking them out.
Do we know the current situation there? Because it seems like it is centering on this steel plant.
That's right, Anderson. CNN has actually spoken with the Ukrainian commander who is inside the Azovstal steel plant, along with hundreds of civilians who are reportedly there taking cover. He described the situation as being absolutely critical at this moment, and he essentially implored any third country to come forward and try to broker some kind of an extraction agreement. He urged America in particular. He said this is a strong country with a strong leader, President Joe Biden, and he was essentially begging for the U.S. to take a sort of primary role in trying to get these people out safely. He said, this is a matter of utmost urgency. This may be the last time you hear my voice. We have possibly a few days, but probably a few more hours before we could potentially all die. There are people with injuries inside that steel plant. There are people who have various needs. There's not enough food. There's not enough water. We don't know how many Ukrainian forces are still holed up in there, but clearly it is a dire situation and looking more and more bleak by the moment, Anderson.
Ed, in your piece, it's so, you know, it's one family, one son looking for his father, and that is a story which is repeated thousands, if not tens of thousands of times in Ukraine now, every single day, with people who have been separated, who don't know where another loved one may be.
And this is in an area, Anderson, that has been freed of Russian occupation. There's still so much of this country that remains under Russian occupation where we don't even have a full extent of the horrors that have occurred there. But in these areas around Kyiv, where the Russian forces are gone, there is just an overwhelming amount of work that is being done. There are investigators combing through neighborhoods, digging up graves of people. Unidentified bodies are stacking up in the morgue. No real system in place yet to be able to kind of clear all of this information and get the answers to these families. The amount of DNA testing that will be needed to confirm the identities of people and connect them with their loved ones is just an overwhelming, monumental task at this moment.
And Clarissa, there were reportedly no civilian corridors open today. I know you visited a town on the Eastern Front earlier. What did you see? How many people are there and want to try to get out if they can?
Well, we're still here in this town of Bakhmut. It's less than 20 miles away from the town of Popasna, where some of the heaviest fighting has been underway throughout the day. Russian forces pushing into that area. Volunteers desperately trying to get civilians out who want to evacuate. But the problem that they're finding again and again, Anderson, is that people make the decision to evacuate once it is already too late to safely evacuate them. So today, when we were walking around and talking to the handful of people who were lining up outside an ATM to get out some cash and asking them what they were still doing there when you could clearly hear artillery, granted in the distance, but it's clear the trajectory for this Russian offensive, and they would all tell you the same thing. Well, we're listening very carefully. When it gets too close, maybe we'll leave, but we don't want to leave. This is a poor area, Anderson. People have worked very hard to buy their homes. They don't want to leave them. They've seen some of the scenes that you saw in Ed's piece there, the kind of mayhem that was left behind after Russian forces finally did depart, and you could see the amount of looting and stealing and destruction that had taken place. And because of that, in part, people here are reluctant to leave their homes. They feel that they can stick it out. They've been living through 8 years of war here already. This is definitely a different, much more intensified phase, but they are hardy, resilient people, and they believe that that they can get through it. And that is creating a really challenging dynamic for Ukrainian authorities here, who are desperately imploring people to leave and who are still seeing quite a few holdouts. I'll give you an example. The region of Luhansk, it's usually would have about 350,000 people living there. It's gone down to 70,000 now. That's a dramatic decrease, Anderson. That's still 70,000 people who are potentially going to be in danger as this offensive gets underway.
Yeah. Clarissa Ward, Ed Levandera, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Just ahead, a mom in a basement in Kyiv with three kids. Elena Ganes is her name. We've talked to her for weeks now. Now her husband, who's been defending Kyiv, may soon be heading to the fighting in the east. One family's view of the war. Also, breaking news about the lifting of the mask mandate for travelers in the U.S., the Department of Justice weighing in whether or not they're going to challenge it. We learned today that Kyiv's deputy mayor has requested 200,000 gas masks in case of a chemical attack. The life in Kyiv has certainly gotten better. There is still much to be fearful of. Just before airtime, I spoke with Elena Ganes, who has appeared a number of times in our show. Her husband may have to leave his job defending Kyiv and head out to the battle out east. I spoke to her earlier. Elena, thank you so much for agreeing to talk again. How are you? How are your family doing?
Hi, very glad to see you again. Looks like we are fine. Yeah, we are all alive, not wounded. It's already 50 days that Ukraine keeps its resistance. More and more countries support us, giving us more weapons. And look like our army is using these weapons wisely. Yes, and it looks like we will get the victory in Ukraine.
We played last night a video from Mariupol that was taken by Ukrainian military forces in a basement, and it was children. It was kids probably 10, 11, 12 years old. And just to hear them, to see them, you know, stuck in this basement around the clock, all eagerly, you know, the person behind the camera asked them if they wanted to go somewhere else, and they all said yes. It was just so heartbreaking to see the life inside this basement and then to know what the city above them looks like, a city they probably would not even recognize right now because it has been so destroyed.
I don't even imagine how they feel. You see, when I was stuck in the basement in Kyiv, I like had a lot of hope. You know, I was more sure than we will survive, you know. But those guys in Mariupol, they are like, you know what I mean, yes?
Yeah,
we all understand.
Do.
For so long, there was no any... It's very hard to keep your hope for them.
I know your husband had volunteered to defend and protect Kyiv, and that's what he and so many others have been doing. I understand he's now actually part of the military. He has a uniform, finally. Are you concerned that he might have to go to the east?
Yeah, I am concerned, and this is the reality. So there are two options. One option, he stays in Kyiv, like patrolling, where it's relatively safe right now, or he is sent to the east because some other people from Kyiv territorial defense are sent to the east already. Yes, I am concerned. Yeah. But he said that he will go if needed.
The choices that your family is forced to make, the choices that so many families across Ukraine are forced to make, individuals are forced to make, they don't make the headlines, but that is what is one of the horrors of war. These impossible choices, these unfair choices one is forced to make or asked to make.
I don't know. I don't think that he was hesitating much about what he should do. Mm-hmm. He is just following what his consciousness tells him how to go.
He's following his conscience.
Let's say I wasn't surprised when he said that he will go.
Yeah. You met him. You've been together 15 years. I understand it was just your 15th anniversary. And can you talk a little bit about how you met? I mean, you were both, I mean, you're young now, but you were so young. You were like 21, weren't you?
Yes, we were students. Basically, we met when we were even younger, when we were like 18, 19 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, but we started, you know, 3 years after we were friends, once upon, like one evening, he just asked me, can I kiss you? And yeah, I said yes, and that was the best decision I ever done in my life.
Well, I heard another story, which that you were both studying French, and that he that his first kind of ask of you was in French.
Yes, like he approached me, so, you know, beautiful young man, and asked me like, voulez-vous vous promener avec moi?
Will you go for a walk like, with me?
Yeah, exactly. Since then, I started to learn French better. Yeah, and we spent our honeymoon in Paris. And right now, Kaitsa, she learns French too. She studies at school where they learn like French. And yeah.
What a walk you two have been on together all these years.
I didn't expect to have three children with
you. and Darina is crawling now. I saw a video that you put on YouTube. I mean, that's such a huge thing.
Oh yes. Darina is crawling right now. On this video, she seems surprised herself that she's crawling, but she's basically doing this faster and faster every day. Now it's getting much more complicated, you know, with her, because she is demanding something exactly. She wants to get it. She wants to put it into her mouth, especially somebody's shoes, for example.
Yeah, shoes was, I think, my son's Wyatt's first word, and he still is obsessed with shoes and boots, and he comments about everybody's shoes and, you know. Elena Guinness, I so appreciate you talking to us as always, and I wish you and your family the best.
Thank you, Anderson. Thank you.
All right, and happy anniversary.
Thanks.
Elena posts a lot about her life and her family's life in the war on her on a YouTube channel. The title is What is Ukraine? Just ahead, is Russia's war exposing the country's weaknesses? New York Times columnist Tom Friedman thinks so. He joins us after the break. The Pentagon today indicated that at least 1,000 more Russian troops have entered the east of Ukraine in the last 24 hours. Their military's poor performance around Kyiv is the subject of New York Times' Tom Friedman's latest column. China and Russia are giving authoritarianism a bad name, is the title. Friedman compares Russia's setbacks to separate ones endured by China in their vaccines and the way they've handled COVID. He writes, in short, both Moscow and Beijing find themselves suddenly contending with much more powerful and relentless forces and systems than they ever anticipated. And the battles are exposing to the whole world and to their own people the weaknesses of their own systems, so much so that the world now has to worry about instability in both countries. Tom Friedman, who's also the author of bestsellers including The Lexus and The Olive Tree, joins us now. One of the things you wrote toward the end of your piece, you said high coercion authoritarian systems are low information systems, so they often drive blind more than they realize. It's refreshing to hear that because I think there's been a lot of talk over the past years that people are looking at authoritarian systems as if they had some great advantage over democracies.
You know, there's no question, Anderson, that the emergence of cyber tools, facial recognition tools, social networks, drones, they seem to make these efficient authoritarians even more efficient, and they seem to make democracies more ungovernable, up to a point. And what we saw with Putin was that he basically beat up a bunch of ragtag armies in Syria, Grozny, Georgia, but he never really faced a Western army, Western trained with precision weapons.
Also, as you pointed out in previous articles, he was able to do that in Grozny and able to do that in Aleppo and elsewhere because there weren't enough. There were some very, very, very brave reporters who were there covering it and photographers. But the world was not watching closely day after day, and the citizens didn't have cell phone cameras that they were uploading, and we weren't seeing this flood of images from those places.
Exactly, which was another restraining force on him in Ukraine that didn't exist in these other theaters. So he had a system, basically, that was up against weak systems in all of these wars over the last decade, and he basically thought the same thing was going to happen in Ukraine. Instead, he triggered a war with a very strong system that is a Ukrainian one, highly motivated, but trained for almost a decade now and backed with some of the most sophisticated weapons, but also training on those weapons to operate in very small groups against very massed Russian military armor, brigades. And he got his nose bloodied. Even more so, Anderson, it's hard for us to appreciate because we couldn't see the battle. It is impossible to exaggerate what a loss it was for Russia that their command ship, their most advanced naval warship, was sunk in the Black Sea by a Ukrainian missile, which was never used in war before. It was probably a prototype. Hmm. Now, you have to get a cascade of things wrong to do that. This ship not only failed to operate its air defenses. This ship was responsible for all the air defenses of the rest of the Russian fleet. So I would not have wanted to have been the Russian admiral who had to call Putin. This was that was said to be his favorite ship, and say, "Boss, sorry, it went down in the Black Sea."
There were early on in the pandemic. I think I saw a video online. I think it was of Dr. Oz. I think when he was still a TV doctor. Saying, well, what China's doing, we should just replicate that here of locking down these places. And as you write about, that's the example of China in this, which, and their vaccine has not proved as efficacious as other vaccines developed in the U.S. and elsewhere. And that you said in the article, I'm worried sick about our own democratic system, but as long as we can still vote out incompetent leaders and maintain information ecosystems that will expose systematic lying and defy censorship, we can adapt in an age of rapid change. And that's the single most important competitive advantage a country can have today.
You know, if you think about it, Anderson, in the last little less than a decade, the leaders of the three most powerful countries in the world all tried to extend their terms, in effect, unconstitutionally. One was named Donald Trump. The second was named Vladimir Putin. And the third was named Xi Jinping. Now, our system restrained Trump from doing that and eventually evicted him from office. It worked to our benefit, I believe. But the Russian and Chinese systems couldn't do that. Now, the claim of these leaders to be presidents for life, both Xi and Putin, is that they're infallible. I mean, why else would you want someone to be president for life? He or she is infallible. They know everything. And so it is very threatening to the president of China when the strategy he chose, and we have to give China credit at some level. I mean, it was credit the use of its authoritarian system to lock down the country, but it did keep its economy going for those 2 years and a lot of people free of COVID. But it was all built on not acquiring any natural immunity. And when it turned out their vaccines were not that good and Omicron overwhelmed it and no one had natural immunity, they were left with nothing else but to shut down, lock down the basically the biggest financial center, not only in China, but probably in the world, called Shanghai.
Yeah. Tom Friedman, appreciate it as always. Thank you.
Thanks.
We'll have more on the war in Ukraine later. Up next, travelers across the country filled with both confusion and excitement as many people ditch their masks with a mask mandate for public transportation no longer in effect. But the decision overturning the mandate could be appealed soon. Details on that ahead. With the mask mandate no longer in effect for travelers, the Justice Department this evening said they'll appeal Monday's court ruling that overturned the public transportation mask mandate if the CDC determines the requirement is still needed. And just moments ago, the CDC said they're still weighing if the mask mandate is needed to protect public health. This comes after the Department of Health and Human Services Secretary said the Biden administration will likely appeal the court decision. But as the White House navigates the chaos surrounding the ruling, there's also confusion for travelers with inconsistent masking rules across different airports and transit systems. CNN's aviation correspondent Pete Montin has this story.
Masks will be optional this evening for all crew and passengers as well.
Onboard celebrations across the country, but also confusion within the travel industry that is facing a new patchwork of mask rules. Some airports will still require masks, such as New York's Kennedy and LaGuardia, even though nearby Newark Airport will not. Masks will also be required on New York's subway system, as well as other mass transit systems that impose their own rules.
This was not an orderly shift. This is not the way that you move public policy.
The sweeping new changes come during a spring break travel surge. The latest TSA numbers say more than 11 million people flew nationwide over the long Easter weekend. With what could be a huge summer travel season on the horizon, the CDC remains firm on its guidance, telling travelers to continue to wear masks, even in the absence of a federal mandate.
Just because this ruling was made by a judge doesn't mean that suddenly the science has changed.
In her decision, U.S. District Judge Catherine Kimball Mizell likened the mandate to detention and quarantine. The U.S. airlines that had previously banned thousands of passengers for violating mask rules are now letting them decide for themselves with mask optional policies.
More comfortable without a mask. I feel very safe, especially since airplanes are one of the safest indoor places.
Even in traveling here and being in downtown in New York and everybody not wear masks and things, I felt much more comfortable keeping mine on.
United Airlines alone banned about 1,000 passengers for not following its mask rules. Now the airline says that some of those passengers will be able to fly again. The airline says it's reviewing those cases on a case-by-case basis. But what's so interesting here, Anderson, is that masks have been a huge driver of unruly passenger incidents. The latest FAA data says about 70% of those incidents this year have been because of masks. Anderson.
Pete Montin, appreciate it. Thanks. Joining me now is former federal prosecutor and CNN chief legal analyst Jeff Toobin. So how likely do you think it is that the ruling will actually be appealed by the Department of Justice?
Anderson, I have to say, I've never heard or seen a statement like this from the Justice Department. It's very peculiar the way they just sort of push the hot potato over to the CDC. The CDC has to decide whether they think the ban has to be reinstated just for the following 2 weeks. That's the only issue before the CDC. If you listen to President Biden today, he got a little off message, but I think he was channeling what the decision might be. He said, look, it's up to passengers whether they want to wear masks. And that seems to be the way the CDC is going, which would mean the Department of Justice does not appeal and simply lets the mask requirement expire now as opposed to on May 3rd.
Does this have a precedent on the books here?
Well, that's the real argument for an appeal here, because the Justice Department has to be worried that this will be a precedent that limits the ability of the CDC to act in emergencies. And other judges have decided this exact issue in a different way. So there are other precedents out there that the Justice Department could point to, but the risk of not appealing is leaving this ruling on the books and limiting the flexibility of the CDC in the future. But today's statement suggests that's a risk the Department of Justice is willing to take if the CDC thinks it's okay to get rid of masks till May 3rd.
I mean, there would be a risk, I guess, if the Justice Department went and lost the appeal. I mean, if they did file it and then they lost the appeal, that could set in some sort of a precedent as well.
And this case would be appealed to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, which is one of the more conservative courts of appeals. So the odds of a loss are higher here than they would be in another part of the country. So that's probably figuring into why the Justice Department is somewhat reluctant to appeal. But that just underlines how politicized, of course, our courts have become. Democratic appointees and Republican appointees on the federal bench are seeing things in increasingly different ways. This was a new Republican appointee, and she ruled against the Biden administration.
Chuck Tubin, appreciate it. Thanks. More ahead on this next phase of the battle in Ukraine, or Ben Wiedemann visits a hospital on the front lines, and two retired U.S. generals offer their assessment on whether this time Russia is battle ready. More AC360 to come after the break. As we reported earlier, Ukrainian President Zelensky said tonight that the Russian army will be remembered as the source of evil for its attacks on civilians and written in history as the most barbaric and inhumane army in the world. That was his words. As he signals that Russian fire towards Kharkiv and Donbass has significantly increased, soldiers on the front lines are facing new challenges. Our senior international correspondent Ben Wiedemann visited one of the hospitals on the front line. Here's his report.
One operation ends and another begins. This time, a soldier wounded on the front line. Even here, glass doors must be taped to minimize shattering in case of bombing. Sandbags cover the windows. The director of this hospital says thanks to help from abroad, they do not lack for medicine or equipment. What they desperately need is neurosurgeons. That in a war where intense bombardment is the norm. These men are recovering in a special unit specializing in treating concussions sustained in artillery bombardments. When shelling is just steps away, the damage is invisible, but it's there. They suffer from intense headaches, nausea, dizziness, and disorientation. Am I tired? A bit, says Roman, who twice has suffered concussions. Not all wounds bleed.
I was CNN senior international correspondent Ben Wiedemann from a hospital near the front lines. I want to bring in retired Brigadier General Peter Zwack, a former U.S. defense attaché to Russia, and retired Lieutenant General Mark Hertling, former Army commanding general of Europe and 7th Army, and CNN military analyst as well. General Hertling, I'm just wondering, you've obviously been, assessing Russia's army, the Russian army approach to logistics. We've seen all the failures of the supplying troops, getting medical support for soldiers injured on the front lines. As this war enters a new phase, focusing on the Donbass regions, how do you think it's going to change? And do you think they have Is Russia capable of learning from their mistakes? Because that would be ominous, obviously, for Ukrainian forces.
Yeah, the first part, Anderson, is, you know, how is it going to change? I think Ben Wiedemann's report is very prescient from the standpoint of you're going to see a lot of artillery fire. It's called shaping operations. It contributes to the final decisive operations. And the way Russia shapes the battlefield is usually with artillery and a lot of it and close air support. Ben's report also talks about the psychological and physical effects of what happens to soldiers under that intensive fire. What he just described in terms of the intense headaches, nausea, and disorientation is what the U.S. military has found to be mild traumatic brain injury. And it's the effects of not only the physical ramifications of artillery strikes, but also the psychological and the fear that's induced through constantly being under artillery. That's what the civilians, the citizens of Ukraine have felt in places like Mariupol. But now we're going to see it along the front line against the soldiers of Ukraine. Has Russia learned? They have attempted to reduce the amount of battle space they're operating in. They will still have failures in the ability to execute combined arms operation. But truthfully, it doesn't take much to fire a lot of artillery, and they've been doing that for weeks now.
General Zwack, senior U.S. defense officials tell CNN they assess Russia now has 78 battalion tactical groups in Ukraine and is continuing to build up. What do you make of the forces they've assembled, and how do you see what the battle is going to look like?
Numerically, it is substantial, but not overwhelming. And I would say this is likely a polyglot force. There are units that are being brought in that are relatively fresh. The majority of them have already been in the fight. And if they've been coming over, some been coming over from Kyiv and the Belarus front, they've been mangled and quickly reconstituted. And you've got probably serious PTSD in some of those units. So you're going to have different levels of quality that what General Hurtley mentioned, that artillery can somewhat offset. And this is in your footage just now. You saw trundling up BM-21 Grads. These are multiple rocket launchers. They're area of fire. They're indiscriminate. And the Russians likely will have a lot of that firing, conventional artillery. That will help, if you will, their ground troops that are, in theory, supporting tanks into the fight. But how long and how tough will the Russians be with a sustained Ukrainian defense that has also been bloodied, as we've seen, will time will tell. 78 BTGs is a lot. Another dozen is around Mariupol, but not an overwhelming force with a well-led defense and still a shaky foundation for the Russian troops.
And General Hurtling, Russia has shown, if you look at Mariupol, they are perfectly content to decimate a city in order to take it. Even a city, one might have thought, well, if they want Mariupol is, to get a land bridge connecting territories in Crimea, they wouldn't decimate the city. But it doesn't seem that they care. That is actually, it's sickening, but is that an advantage for them, is it not?
Yeah, if you don't care about the effects of murder on a large scale, this is not combat. Anderson, you kill in combat in order to defeat an enemy. What the Russians are doing is murdering civilians. It fits every definition of terror. I looked up, with all the talk about terrorism, I looked up the definition of terror. It's the unlawful use of force and violence against persons or property to intimidate or coerce a government, the civilian population, or any segment thereof, in furtherance of political or social objectives. What we're seeing is a demonstration of the definition of terrorism. And that's why I believe the State Department should, in fact, this is a State Department call, but they should declare that Russia is a state sponsor of terrorism, because Mr. Putin has asked his forces to murder people and to kill civilians. It doesn't get any more clear-cut than that, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. General Hurtling, General Zwack, I really appreciate it. Thank you. It's always good to talk to you. Up next, an update on a story we told you about last week. The latest details on the deadly police shooting of Patrick Liuya and the results from his autopsy. After a video was released last week of the deadly police-involved shooting of 26-year-old Patrick Liuya in Grand Rapids, Michigan, an independent autopsy commissioned by his family so shows that he was shot in the back of his head. Liuya was killed during an encounter with an officer following a traffic stop on April 4th. Videos show him running away from the officer after being instructed to get back in the car. The officer tackles him to the ground. After struggling with Liuya and attempting to tase him, the two wrestle on the ground before the officer tells him to let go of the taser. That is when the officer's body camera was deactivated. Another video then captures the fatal gunshot. The officer is on paid leave while the incident is being investigated. That's it for this episode of AC360. You can check out our lineup of podcasts and showcasts at cnn.com/podcasts or in your favorite podcast app. Thanks for listening.